Israeli voters head back to the polls tomorrow to decide whether or not to give Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu another term. It'll be the second election in the past few months in that country and is one of the key international stories in the coming days. And joining me for our weekly look at some of them is the BBC's Rob Hugh Jones. And Rob, remind us why exactly voters in Israel are casting ballots less than 6 months since the last time they did so?
Well, Mark, as you know, Israeli politics are complex with plenty of different parties, policies and personalities, the three Ps. At the center of it all, the man Benjamin Netanyahu, who has overtaken David Ben-Gurion to be Israel's longest-serving prime minister. And this election, like the previous one, is essentially a referendum on him. Now, in the last election in April, the party of Mr. Netanyahu won the most seats, but it did not win a majority, and that meant he needed to make a coalition of smaller parties to stay in office. He couldn't do that in the time he was allotted by the law, so this week they're going to the polls again.
So what has been at stake in this campaign?
Well, quite a bit, as Mr. Netanyahu has promised, if he wins, to annex a third of the West Bank. That's the territory occupied by Israel where most of the inhabitants are Palestinians, but it's not legally a part of Israel. There are settlements of Israeli Jews who live in the territory. These settlements are considered illegal under international law, but of course Israel denies that judgment. We should add that Mr. Netanyahu has said similar things before. Perhaps he won't keep his promise if he wins. Perhaps he will. This election will be close and he needs Israeli right-wingers to vote for him, hence maybe this inducement. Now, if you look at things from the Palestinian point of view, well, they hope that any future peace deal between them and Israel will result in an actual state of Palestine, the so-called two-state solution. So they're reacting angrily to this pledge, saying it's the end of peace talks if Mr. Netanyahu's plan goes ahead. Israel, of course, is a strong country, but it has this streak of insecurity, understandable given the history of the state and its people. Mr. Netanyahu plays on this to some extent. His campaign has majored on Israel's enemies in Iran, Syria, and Lebanon. His message, repeated time after time, is that the Middle East is a tough neighborhood and he is the only politician who can keep Israelis safe. Election posters also show him with President Donald Trump, both men smiling, suggesting a unique partnership that only Mr. Netanyahu can maintain. And of course, Israel under Netanyahu has received a lot from Washington in the last couple of years. And Mr. Netanyahu is facing several counts of corruption. Analysts say he's hoping for a majority that will help protect him from indictment. His main rival, I should finish on, is a centre-left coalition called Blue and White, led by a retired general, Benny Gantz. And General Gantz says he can restore honour to the premiership. So he says that's his role, if you like, in the kind of post-Netanyahu world.
All right. So Israelis going to the polls tomorrow on Thursday, Rob. A decision in Japan over the nuclear power plant at Fukushima. What's going on there?
Yes. So now your listeners will remember that in March 2011, there was a major earthquake off the coast of Japan. That caused a massive tsunami which came ashore, killing many people and disabling the power supply and cooling of three reactors at Fukushima on the east coast of Japan, facing the North Pacific Ocean. Now, Japan has been struggling ever since with who's responsible for this disaster. Earlier, prosecutors decided not to bring charges against the state power company called TEPCO. But this week, the court will decide if the executives of the company are liable for the disaster. So that's what this week is about.
And Rob, the cleanup for that accident is still taking place. And there's even been talk of running out of space to store the radioactive material. Is that right?
Yes, with such a large area affected, it's been an absolutely massive project to clean up this space. Take a listen to our correspondent here in Japan, Rupert Wingfield Hayes, who's been talking about that effort.
So the really big difference between, for example, what happened in Ukraine with the Chernobyl disaster and what's happened here in Japan at Fukushima is that the Japanese government has decided that this area has to be cleaned and has to be restored. And it is a vast, vast operation that will take many decades to complete. But all of the material that is being cleaned up, all of the topsoil that's being removed, it has to be taken somewhere. And it is being brought here and it is going to be buried. And the quantities are just mind-boggling. 14 million tons of waste material has been created so far. That all has to be buried underground.
And that's Rupert Wingfield Hayes, our reporter in Japan. One of the main issues, I should say, Mark, has been the water they've been using to clean the site, which itself has some radioactive material in it. Last week, a Japanese government official said they were running out of storage capacity for that water and that eventually it will have to be released into the Pacific. The government in Japan later retracted that statement, saying it was just one person's opinion. But you can see, you know, how messy and how convoluted that whole process is.
Yeah, messy, exactly. All right, so Rob, finally on Sunday, an international day to get us thinking about how we get around. What's that about?
Yes, well, on Sunday, it's World Car Free Day, an attempt by environmental campaigners to get cities around the world to promote alternative transportation, especially for short trips. So cities here in England, of course, we are only a small island, for instance, will be closing roads to highlight the effort. And London, where I'm sitting now, will have numerous events out on the streets on Sunday. It's taking place this year on a Sunday, which is convenient because it won't disrupt normal workday commuting. But in years past, there have been some major unintended consequences to car-free days, such as in Madrid, Spain, which experienced massive traffic jams on roads that weren't closed when it happened there. There's also a belief that the more campaigners advertise car-free days, the more people will think that it's actually a good day to drive, i.e. nothing on the roads, meaning that traffic actually in some places, ironically, could get worse on Sunday instead of better.
All right, that's the BBC's Rob Hugh-Jones. Rob, as always, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.